Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to the Zelda Universe Podcast. We appreciate you taking your time and spending some wonderful moments with us as we explore our memories and our experiences in the land of Hyrule and beyond. My name is Connor Schultz. It is a pleasure to be with you once again. Joining me with me today, we have one returning and one new contributor to the podcast. First returning, we have Caden.
Hello. It is always a pleasure to make it to these recording podcasts. I'm a big fan.
And joining us for the first time, Dominic, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sounds great. Hello, everybody. My name is Dominic. I've been a huge fan of the Zelda franchise since I was a little kid. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
We are grateful to have you. Dominic has newly joined up with Zelda Universe as one of our features writers, and we are happy to share his maiden voyage with you all a little bit later on in the podcast. But today, we are starting off, as we tend to do so, with Medley's Melodies, the series in which we choose some of our favorite songs from the Legend of Zelda franchise, or highlighting a special piece of music from the perpetually creative fan community. And it's from that fan community that we are taking our inspiration this time around. And I feel kind of bad, because it is fan-produced, that we can't just slap it on here for you all to listen to. I don't want to take away from the music that they have created, and I can only recommend that you check out the entirety of the production that, in this case, Dr. Pez has produced in connection with several of his fellow contributors. We will leave a link to the full production on YouTube in the description of our podcast. We encourage you to check this out. And it is quite a feast for the senses. How familiar are the two of you with progressive rock? Or as it's defined in here, shortened up to be prog rock.
Good old prog rock. So, though I am a music person, band director, music teacher, and I went through a whole degree centered around music and education and music and music history and all that kind of stuff, I'm going to be honest, I haven't really listened to a whole lot of it. that was never my specialty. But there are a lot of similarities. I listened to the entire thing last night, immaculate work, and there are a lot of similarities to some other games that I've played in recent time, including like games like Ys, big fan of the Ys series of games by Falcom, as well as the Trails games, Trails of Cold Steel, Trails Through Daybreak. Those composers at the Falcom sound team are prog rock to the max. And so if anyone listening to this, if you ever listen to the Dr. Pez Tempo of Time, like a full video, really recommend giving a listen to soundtracks like Ys and Trails, because that music is immaculate. The way the drums are used, as well as even things like piano. Big, big fan of that kind of stuff.
So I'm not a huge progressive rock person. I've never really heard of it. I'm familiar with rock and roll, obviously. I play guitar. I create my own music. I'm fairly experimental with it. But the prog rock genre as a whole is pretty new to me. So when I heard it in the context of Legend of Zelda, my mind was blown. Because the way he starts off the video is he has the title sequence going, and it's very humble, very slow-paced. But as you go through the journey, it gets gradually more and more complex. And I thought that just was so interesting, not only in the context of the music this person created, but like as a metaphor for the hero's journey. So in that vein, I thought it was super interesting. And I'm definitely going to listen to it again today.
For those of you who are unaware, progressive rock basically takes the general concept and the core of rock and roll that we're all familiar with drums and guitars and that rock and roll rhythm, and then begins to add in additional instruments, things that you don't normally attribute to rock and roll, things like trumpets, horns, harmonicas. In this case, since of course this is Ocarina of Time music that we're talking about, the ocarina, it creates a symphonic feel to this musical piece that you are listening to and becomes much more of an orchestral arrangement than just a rock ballad. And this piece goes on for over half an hour, spanning the entirety of the Ocarina of Time experience. Not going through every single piece, but you would be hard-pressed to find a iconic song from that game that is not in this piece. It reminded me of what I had termed, and I don't even know if this is the actual term for it, symphonic metal, which does the exact same thing, just with heavy metal rock, and then adds in full-on orchestral accompaniment.
Right.
Which just creates this whole epic feeling to the music that is being played. And this does it in that exact same vein with multiple genres, honestly. There is the rock and roll point. There is a little bit of heavy metal in there. When you get into, oh gosh, which one was it? The battle section. We get full jazz. And honestly, I felt like I was in the middle of a Cowboy Bebop episode.
I think it's the Ganondorf battle, right?
I think it's just specifically, I mean, there's so much, half an hour, it could have been in both.
Oh yeah, the regular battle. I'm listening to it right now as we're going through it. yeah, the regular battle as well, yeah.
The battle music particularly stuck out to me because it kind of captured the feeling of being in the battle. So you have the original composition by Koji Kondo, which was awesome, and then you have this rendition. It made me feel like on edge, like kind of like jarring, teetering on, am I going to get hit, you know, with the like the jazzy distorted guitar and bass. Just really immerses you in the scene. That's what I loved about it.
And I think, if I'm recalling correctly, it's been forever since I played Ocarina of Time, let alone listen to the regular enemy battle theme. I think it's just like a chugging bass. There's no drums ever at all. So having it in this approach, this progressive rock approach, it's basically like an entirely new song, which I really appreciate. And I think a lot of good covers will add elements that make you sort of rethink how you listen to the original, which I really appreciate. And something that I was really surprised by was the inclusion of the Shadow Temple in this, because it almost felt like a psychedelic sort of, and the visuals obviously of the video also helped that feel, but like the approach with the guitar, it's very unique. It's something that I wasn't really expecting out of this.
With the Shadow Temple, I like how it transitioned from a more chaotic, kind of like orchestral, all these instruments going on at the same time, and then you get to the Shadow Temple and it's just a couple instruments. It really gets that hollow, spooky feeling. I thought that was so cool.
Mm-hmm.
With a symphony, the whole idea is to tell a story through music, nothing else. And the different instruments that are being used, the different leitmotifs, the overall structure is supposed to create that story without ever having to say a word. It's helpful to know the story to begin with. And for those of us who have played Ocarina of Time so many times in our life, it's very easy to pick out, ah, yes, this is where I'm supposed to be. This is what is going on. With the technological limitations of something like the Nintendo 64, there's only so much that you can put into the tracks, whether that is because of the technology or the data involved, how much you can take up. And so when you get people who are passionate and talented enough to start adding in different instruments, you end up creating a much more understandably fuller experience. What would it be like to be in the actual Shadow Temple, surrounded by graves and terrors, literal shadow demons, and the unsettling realization of the horror that lies underneath the surface of this country? That, in a lot of ways, what Dr. Pez in Temple of Time was able to do is spot on.
The dark, blood-soaked history of Hyrule's royal family. Or whatever the game says, I forgot what the exact words were. But
it's, you know what? It's close enough. It's very much there.
Hyrule got some stuff going on back there. Hey, man, there's the Sheikah.
The idea of how much was done in the name of peace or keeping the Triforce a secret, I can only imagine, especially considering the amount of dead bodies that are literally hiding beneath everyone's feet.
And torture chambers.
Fun times. Yeah, fun for the whole family.
You know, guillotines strewn about, torture chambers, you know, it's ready for everyone. It's fine.
Well, thank you very, very much to Rebecca Corgan for bringing this awesome piece to our attention. And again, we will leave the link to the full symphonic Tempo of Time in the description of the podcast for you all to check out. And we move now to The Bomber's Notebook, a series where we take a special look at the various and unique characters found in the Legend of Zelda series. And today we are heading to the waves of Wind Waker and taking a look at, I would say he's fairly antagonistic, but not in any kind of evil sense. We are looking at one of the two frog gods of Wind Waker, Cyclos. And it's interesting when you start bringing up the concept of gods in Zelda, because you run into a whole lot of divine spirits and entities through the course of our adventures in Hyrule. And I'm kind of wondering what the tier system is in regards to where these gods all fit.
That's something that I never really thought about before reading the article. Is, you know, there are mentions of other gods, right? But aside from the Golden Goddess, aside from even Hylia, which Hylia, as an entity, wasn't really a thing until Skyward Sword. We had Lake Hylia and stuff like that, but the Hylia, the character, wasn't really a thing until Skyward Sword. So we still have like the Goddess of the Sand, even the mention of Goddess of Time in Majora's Mask, which I don't think the article mentions. Could be wrong. But that was something I never really thought about, was that there's got to be like some sort of theological hierarchy. Like you have the creation gods, but then also the lesser deities of so-and-so.
I feel like it's hard to say because kind of like the Zelda timeline, it kind of goes all over the place.
Right.
Like you have the three goddesses who have the pearls, and then you have Cyclos and his brother. I think they preside over the Great Sea, but that's their only domain. And then you have higher up in the hierarchy, you have the three, I forget their names, Feor, Din, and Nehru, I think.
Good job.
Yeah.
You have passed your Zelda knowledge test.
Amazing. And then maybe above them is Hylia. Like, because Hylia's never, like you said, you have Lake Hylia, but who was Hylia?
Right. I would think the the three golden goddesses would be above Hylia because she wasn't really involved with the creation of the world, mostly just the Master Sword and using the Triforce, not necessarily creating it. But she
Maybe
is
my wires
also,
crossed.
she's also worshipped, so the most, I would imagine, out of all of them.
The timeline was a mistake. I will always assert that. And when we get to this kind of description of gods, I feel like the Japanese, the Shintoism description of kami, translated roughly as gods in English, is probably a little bit more apt here.
Yes.
For those who are unfamiliar, when we're talking about kami as opposed to god in the Western sense, we are talking about spirits that are innately connected to particular beings, concepts, life energies,
phenomena.
Basically something that has so much spiritual energy attached to it in some form or another, either due to worship or to just the life energy of the world concentrated in one point, that it basically manifests itself in its own personality and sometimes physical being. So something like the great Deku Tree, who is himself a god, if you will, a kami, a great spirit of the forest, which is then extends out into the Lost Woods and by extension the entirety of the world. The Deku Tree is basically a manifestation of the spirit of the land. While Cyclos here is a spiritual manifestation of the storms on the Great Sea. Storms would arise, they would cause havoc, and I'm sure people who are just now living on these seas and trying to figure out how this works are very concerned about these storms and do what they can to appease it, since, of course, this is Zelda. We're talking over the course of hundreds, if not thousands of years, and that eventually manifests itself in Cyclos, who is himself a very stormy personality, kind of matching what he does.
Right. It's something that I found really interesting is recently I've been on somewhat of a Greek mythology kick, and I've somewhat drawn parallels. And obviously, Zelda's made by Nintendo, which is a Japanese company, so they're more in tune with the Shintoology, Shinto mythos, and that kind of stuff. But I do think there are some similarities with Greek mythology, Greco-Roman mythology, in that they sort of personify natural events, concepts, as just like most of the kami, where I'm thinking to the Odyssey, you don't really meet Poseidon isn't really a character. It's more so just the storm and the waves and the ocean being relentless and just absolutely demolishing everything. Not necessarily, obviously, it's mythology, so Poseidon is a mythological god, but throughout history, you have the goddess of the harvest, goddess of hunting, just concepts that get personified into beings. And Zelda, obviously with kami and Shintoism, same similar things happening. You also have Valu and Jabun in Wind Waker that are also great spirits of their respective, elements and settings. And I think, yeah, Cyclos and Zephos, right?
Yes.
You have one of them is for tornadoes and storms, and the other one is for the winds, like guiding winds and that kind of stuff. Concepts that a sailor in the great sea would be like, oh, I pray to the god of the winds to send me in the right direction, set my sails, that kind of stuff. But now they're personified for some reason as frogs. I'm not sure what the design intention is there for the frogs. I'm sure there's something.
There's always an inspiration for something or other.
Oh yeah.
Something that sticks out to me regarding how they created the gods. So specifically in the Wind Waker, because it's cell shaded, it has this like childlike charm that kind of like manifests itself in the gods that preside over the Great Sea. So you have the two wind gods, the frogs, Valu, but it's done in a way that it's not so serious. You have this like whimsy versus sensibility that I think is just really funny, because you have this angry whirlwind of chaos who turns out just to be this silly goofball. Once you shoot him with arrows, he comes down, you're like, oh, he's gonna get me. And he's like, that's a wicked arm you got there. And I just think this is interesting because it presents the characters and even its gods kind of as camp, like not taken too seriously, just kind of funny, go with the flow, laissez-faire. And I just love that.
Yeah.
It's always funny when you have, and it this does happen in various mythos where you have some god or another who looks all big and intimidating or whatever, but if you show something that impresses them, they're like, dang, you! Good job! You did a good job! Here, have a thing! Oh,
Yes.
thank you. I thought you were going to kill me, but I will take this. Thank you much!
Yep. I also want to point out, it's not going to be in the video because it's only audio, but in my backdrop I have an Okami wall portrait, and I thought that was, I think that's just very, very apt, very, very topical.
So good.
Good stuff. Well, thank you to Aaron Talen for opening this page of the Bomber's Notebook for us. And we move on to the realm of memories, the series where we reflect on our absolute favorite moments in the Legend of Zelda games. Today, our games are taking us to both Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom for what Briar Washabaugh calls a major test of wit. I'm overemphasizing wit because, I don't know, I think it sounds funny. What is the thing about both of those games that everyone hates the most?
Breakable weapons.
Breakable weapons.
Yep.
I have a convention panel where I go over all of the different Zelda games, and for Breath of the Wild in particular, I have someone put together a montage that I put onto the thing where it does I forget which operatic piece it is, but it's basically played in time to weapon breaking just over and over again, and it is absolutely hilarious. But once you get past a certain point where you have enough weapon slots and strong enough weapons, that becomes less of an issue, I've noticed.
Yeah.
Because then it's just a, oh, wow, I have another weapon that I want. Which do I get rid of? What am I doing? What is. So then, of course, you get to that point where it's, ah, you're so used to having all of these weapons. Remember what it was like when you didn't have all these weapons? And that's the focus of the Realm of Memories today. What it's like to suddenly have all of your items, all of your weapons, all of your clothing just yanked from you, and you have to start back at square one.
Yeah. The big one from Breath of the Wild obviously was Eventide Island. I guess that's what we're going to be hitting mostly. And something that I really didn't really draw a parallel to in my initial playthrough initially was the Forsaken Fortress in Wind Waker. Always back to Wind Waker. And how, yeah, like same thing. You get there and oh, no equipment for you. Figure it out. I enjoy the change up, especially when it's a surprise, like Eventide was for a lot of us.
I think there's a distinction though, like with the Forsaken Fortress, you have to reclaim what you lost. But with Eventide Island, you have everything taken away. It's a little different, but what I found exciting about it was when I first played through the game, I found it pretty much right away, and I think I had maybe 5 hearts.
Oh no!
So I'm like, what do I do? And I didn't want to go back because I had already made it to the island. So
I'm impressed you got there.
I don't know what I did. I don't remember. All I remember is it took me several tries to beat this because 5 hearts, right? So I got killed maybe 20 times or something. But I was able to do it with 5 hearts, or maybe it was, I don't know, 5 or 6.
But you did it. That's what matters.
But, I don't know, people knock Breath of the Wild because of breakable weapons, but at the same time, then things just stay the same and you know what I mean. Let me say
repetition or repetitive?
Repetitious.
There you go.
with Breath of the Wild, it created something completely innovative. Like
innovative.
Innovative. Oh my goodness. Yeah, you can just cut all this out.
Never. It's funnier that way.
I don't care. you have this new thing where you have breakable weapons and you get 10 hits. You're like, oh no, what do I do? And it forces the player to think outside the box instead of, oh, I have the Master Sword. Oh, I have the Kokiri Sword. Like, things are all right. And I really like it because even Shigeru Miyamoto said, when he was a kid, he would just go explore caves and forests. And I think that relates to the games.
You know, Miyamoto was one of those kids who was like, ah, yes, look at this stick. I like this stick. This is a good stick.
I can totally see that.
Welcome to Stick Nation.
And this is the fact that it tends to come later on in the game when you've gotten used to the whole system. And you suddenly are reverted back to square one is where the challenge is most prominent. The initial image for this article is in the Trial of the Sword, which is honestly what I thought the whole article was going to be about when I first saw it, and where my memory tends to go most prominently, because the Trial of the Sword does the exact same thing on a repetitive basis, and you don't get to have much option in what it is you have to work with. It is whatever happens to be in the room at the time, whatever you happen to say from the previous rooms, and you better hope you have what you think you need. Doing that on Master Quest was, in particular, a nightmare. The later rooms are never the challenge that you think they're going to be. It's the early rooms when you have things that are going to break immediately and you have enemies that are not only tougher than they're supposed to be, they recharge health. Which means you have to be accurate, you have to be fast, and you have to be strategic because those freaking Lizafuls are the bane of my existence.
In the Trial of the Sword, when that first came out, I had to put it down because I was like, I can't deal with this right now. And that was base game, not even master mode, just regular mode. I later revisited it, I think like a month before Tears of the Kingdom came out, because I was like, I have to beat this before Tears of the Kingdom. That's my goal. And I did it somehow, like very, very quickly somehow. I don't know how. But those early / middle rooms, oh, absolute nightmare. The screenshot that's in the article of the one with the gust of wind and the boat, insane. I wanted to scream, but I didn't somehow. And that concept I really enjoyed when it was sort of brought back for Tears of the Kingdom with those trials, the shrine challenges, where it's just stripped to the essentials or nothing, basically, just like Eventide. but centered around a central concept, like dodging or hiding or luring or that kind of stuff. I think that was a really cool twist, or not really a twist, really, but adaptation of the strip to the bare essentials sort of thing.
Especially the dark room trials, I
Oh,
found
yeah.
them more difficult than Eventide Island, because at least with Eventide Island, you could run around and get away from anything that was chasing you for the most part. But with the darkness rooms, like if you haven't done it before, you have no idea what's happening, and
Right.
you kind of have to just take a shot in the dark, so to speak. Pun intended.
Thankfully, the sorry,
Go ahead.
I was
Good.
just I was just I was gonna say, thankfully, in Breath of the Wild, the Tieflo ruins didn't take away any of your weapons, because I would have probably cried, to be honest.
Nothing amps up difficulty like thinking you understand what is going on, and then all of a sudden you have no idea what is going on. And that's kind of where you end up with these challenges. You think you know, you have all of this stuff, and then, oh, wait, now you don't. Wait, so what do I have? What am I doing? What's going on? That's what makes these challenges fun.
And Dominic, you said that you had stumbled onto Eventide way early in the game, right?
Right.
So, and this is Breath of the Wild, I assume your first playthrough.
Yes.
So that's even more of like a, I barely know how this game even functions. Now I have to deal with not having anything anymore and having to get through this challenge. I think that's, I'm sure there's quite the contrast of like stumbling into Eventide way later in the game versus at the very beginning. And I think that also applies to the Tears of the Kingdom challenges as well. The like you have the experience of how the game functions versus not. I can imagine that's a whole different realm.
Well, it was not only exciting, but since you have so few opportunities to get hit, it made it even like you had to be more creative with what you're doing. Because if you broke your weapon in the middle of combat, there's a chance you get hit and killed right away. Versus late game, you can get hit 20 times, it's fine. But it. Yeah, it was super fun. It was super exciting. I enjoyed it. I hope it a similar kind of challenge is in one of the newer games to come. But knowing Nintendo, it won't be the same, which is great.
Have you played Echoes of Wisdom?
I did. I beat it pretty much right away. It was awesome. Not only to play as Zelda, but also the new mechanic of playing the game was really exciting.
Did you
Taking,
do the challenge runs?
I didn't do the challenge runs. I think I just did the main quest. I didn't spend too much time on Echoes of Wisdom, because I got back into Tears of the Kingdom.
Well, if you want another of those challenges, one of the some several of the challenges in that game, start you from zero, use what's in
Oh,
the room,
sweet.
do it all over again, and you're on a time limit. Or at the very least, you're being timed. So yeah, they know what they're doing. Well, thank you once again to Briar Washabaugh for contributing to the realm of memories. And we head now to our featured article of the month. Dominique, this is your maiden voyage. Welcome once again to the Zelda Universe team.
Ahoy.
And
Gracious.
ahoy, ahoy indeed, as we jump back to Wind Waker, as well as its direct sequels, both Phantom Hourglass and Spirit Tracks. And looking at its overall design, its tone, its. Every time I see discussions like this, I always have to revisit what it was like when this game was first announced. Dominic, this is where we start showing our age. I turned 38 2 days from as of this recording. Caden, you're pretty close to me, I think. No, you're in your 20s. You're in your 20s.
Yeah. Mid-20s, 26.
So, I'm the old man in the room.
I'm 29, so... Or 28.
Okay.
So, I didn't really know what happened.
Oh my gosh.
I know now.
Yeah, you know now. But it is impossible to describe, and unfortunately, this is just one of those things that will get hammered anytime Wind Waker gets discussed, because people get enraged about gaming decisions nowadays. You have no idea. You have no idea what it was like when all you had was Ocarina of Time, Link to the Past, Majora's Mask, high fantasy. This was our Lord of the Rings as gamers. Attached to this, we had epics like Final Fantasy VII. This was the stuff that we were used to when it came to fantasy and video games. And then we got Wind Waker announced. What the heck, Nintendo? What were you possibly thinking? Sending us this kiddie game. Because that's what it looked like to us. People were swearing off Nintendo and Zelda as a franchise because this game was announced. And it was not a minority opinion. This was not an eclectic little group in the corner of some social media, because social media didn't exist. This was a very large player base that was enraged at the idea that Wind Waker was a thing, or was going to be a thing. And now here we are, 20 years later, 25 years later, really. And now here you are, Dominic, making the argument that Wind Waker needs to make a resurgence.
So... the thing is, I'm not advocating for another cel-shaded game. I'm not advocating for something that is necessarily the same as Wind Waker. I don't want to play another Wind Waker. What I'm advocating for is playing a game that tugs at the heartstrings, that really like makes me feel invested in the game and makes me like value the characters. So, for example, when you start the game, you're woken up by your sister. A lot of people have that experience. For me, I did. I have four sisters. So you know what it's like to be awoken from your slumber. And she's like, "Grandma's got a present for you." Jump out of your tower, swim to shore, run past the booger kid, get to their house. And she gives you these clothes. You're like, why should I wear these?
Did you have booger kids growing up?
Sorry, let me rephrase that. The booger kid on the beach in Wind Waker. But I've had some pretty gross kids around my neighborhood as a kid. But yeah, like the aspect I found most significant about that game is the narrative, the characters, everything coming to a point when your sister's taken from you. From your island, and it's your mission to save her. So instead of saving a princess, you save your sister, who, for a child, for somebody, I think I was six, it's significant. It's like, oh my god, my sister is taken. It's not just some princess. So for me, it was like, oh my goodness, like, I gotta go save her. So even if it was a different style of game compared to Ocarina of Time, I wouldn't have known the difference. But yeah, I love the narrative aspect. I also love the sound effects and all like the subtle nuances. So when you kill an enemy, you have the purple cloud of smoke come out. I thought that was so cool. And you get the sound effects when the rupees go everywhere when you hit the swirling object, when you kill a knight, or a moblin. Just those like subtle things, or like you're chasing somebody on Windfall Island. And if you get caught, they like give you a dirty look, and they say something mean to you, like that kind of thing. So when I played Tears of the Kingdom or Breath of the Wild, like it's still Zelda, it's still fun, like it's new, it's exciting, all these different mechanics, but I just didn't connect to the characters. Perhaps maybe I like Cass from Breath of the Wild, like they were interesting. Beedle was interesting, but I didn't relate to the characters in the same way. And that's just kind of where I'm coming from, that emotional investment. And maybe people feel differently, like that's just my perspective.
Yeah, there. So Wind Waker was my first game ever, I think, as like a conscious human being. Like I played it. I was born in '99. Played it when I was like 4, 5. I don't know. And it similar things like just experiencing Outset Island and interacting with these characters, drawing parallels. My grandma was a big part of my life growing up, and she's actually the one who got me into video games, surprisingly.
Cool.
Good for
So like,
her.
yeah, and she's still playing her Xbox 360 right now.
I love it.
That's amazing.
She gave me her Switch. I have it in the living room, and she's living her best life right now. But like, I drew that connection with Wind Waker, so like, I also have the personal connection. And now nowadays, later in life, the we realize how much Wind Waker, how many new things Wind Waker did for the series, in terms of like tone, obviously, but also setting, plot, style, like so many firsts for the series happened in Wind Waker. And I do have to agree, like I love Breath of the Wild, Tears of the Kingdom. I think they're great games. But with a lot of something I've been saying is there's a lot of sacrifices that needed to be made in order for for Tears of the Kingdom and Breath of the Wild to be open air. And I think one of those things is, you know, story and how connected you are to the characters. Because it's so open-ended, there's a lot you can't really do because you have to take into account for it being open. I think some things that could have been done to like maybe help the characters in those two games is give Tulin a couple of side quests. Like it's just you and Tulin just going into the world and doing something to help you interact with the characters more outside of their main story quests, or just something along those lines, you know? Because in a more linear aspect for like Wind Waker, you're able to develop with Medli, and then you get her back for the Earth Temple area, and then you develop with Makkar and get him back for the Wind Temple area, and it's like a whole growth journey that you're going on, and I think a lot of that is sacrificed for the sake of the open end. I still love the open air games, but I think there are a lot of sacrifices that had to be made, my personal opinion.
Something I didn't mention, which I also think lends itself well to cel-shaded games or animated games, is just the amount of expression in the game. So Wind Waker, like, Link is so expressive. Like, when something happens, he gets scared, you see it on his face, or if he's angry or frustrated, or if he's happy, like, you can see it in the character. So with, like, Breath of the Wild or Tears of the Kingdom, it's a different art style, that's for sure, but you don't have that same expression. Game I'm playing right now, Kingdom Hearts 2. I never played Kingdom Hearts. Sora has that same kind of animated expression. I'm like, oh my God, like this is a real person. This is somebody I can relate to.
Yeah. With Wild Link, that's probably one of my biggest. I'm saying a lot of negative things about the Wild games, but I really do enjoy them. They're ranked fairly high on my Zelda ranking, but just Link, he's definitely not one of my favorite parts of the game or one of my favorite Links, just because, you know, he just doesn't do anything or show anything on his face beyond eating good food or getting kissed by the great fairies. And
Good
I
times.
just wanted more out of him.
Those fairies, oh my God.
There's a lot of discussion over what makes a Zelda game a Zelda game, and a lot of people have used Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom as a demarcation line. A lot of people saying, this doesn't feel like Zelda anymore, or this finally feels like Zelda again. And it's fascinated me to hear those differing opinions, because for me, I never felt a distinction. What makes a Zelda game is often a little bit more bare bones than I think what people are expecting, from my perspective at the very least. And so all of them have always felt like Zelda games to me, primarily because they have the same kind of overall tone. And that tone does technically change a little bit from game to game, because you can certainly say that Majora's Mask is very different from something like Minish Cap. But at the same time, the overall adventure and the overall messages remain the same. Zelda is a very simple story, regardless of which game that you are playing. How much emotional investment that you end up putting towards the game and the characters in the game is a question of, one, how much are you putting into the characters? And how much is the game putting those characters out for you? So, a lot of people for the longest time questioned, why is it called The Legend of Zelda when Zelda is barely in the games? Well, how much investment are you putting towards Zelda? The games are not giving you too many opportunities, at least until a lot more recently, to see Zelda and interact with Zelda. So what does that make Zelda to you as a player? The characters in Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, you don't get a whole lot of interaction with them. And I agree that we would have been better served if, for example, in Tears of the Kingdom, if instead of having these little echo things following us around, why not have the actual characters hanging out with us? I think from a story perspective, that would have been amazing. Do something like Dragon Age, where the characters will banter with each other every now and again. That would have been hilarious and fun. But everyone loves Tulin. Tulin is a good boy. He does a good job. Riju is awesome. Because that's the kind of investment that we somehow are able to put into those characters.
Yeah. With the champions in Breath of the Wild, I think they... Organized thoughts, Caden. I think the champions are able to get just a bit more of that connection to the audience because of the memories. We're seeing more of them more often, whereas with the sages, we don't see a whole lot of them. We see them in their regional phenomenon thingy, we do the dungeon with them, and then they stick around over there, and we go on our adventure. I do appreciate, though, that a centralizing theme of Tears of the Kingdom is community. You know, taking hands with your neighbor and building and you know, defeating evil. The big theme of the game is hands. Every handshake with the sages. The music has audible clapping for the main theme. And I think a lot of that could have been even more emphasized if, like, as you said, Connor, with having the party just with you most of the time, being able to see those interactions. I always love character interactions that we don't usually get. With the MCU, random side tangent, I loved Infinity War, having characters from opposite sides of the galaxy, like, interact. Rocket Raccoon interacting with Captain America, like, and Winter Soldier. Like, character interactions just make me more invested with them, and I think that could have really played a good part in Tears of the Kingdom. And Breath of the Wild, but mostly Tears of the Kingdom. We got a little bit of that with the Phantom Ganon fight in Hyrule Castle. They were all together in one room. They saved Link. And then at the very end, they come together to fight the Phantoms in the final battle. But we don't see any of those interactions. And it's that's kind of hurts. To me.
No, you're perfectly right. As I'm streaming Tears of the Kingdom right now, and as I am thinking of ways in which the story could have been better fleshed out, it's a little harder to do it now than with Ocarina of Time, where it's just a constant, oh, this thing could have happened, we could have had this discussion. Because Tears of the Kingdom is so open as a game, it's hard to fill that whole time with story beat, story beat, story beat, story beat, because it's not set up that way. But there are certainly plenty of opportunities of, oh, Yunobo is in the depths for the first time. He had this experience. Now Sidon is down here. What's his reaction to all of this? How are these characters bouncing off of each other? Which is so fun to be able to get when you have characters. And it provides an opportunity to flesh those characters out. With Wind Waker, and then also to Phantom Hourglass, Spirit Tracks, because they're in that same vein, you get to see what happens with characters, and you can see how they are reacting because of those facial expressions, particularly with Link. You feel more connected because you feel like you are seeing his personality despite the fact that he's not really saying anything. You do get that in Wind Waker Tears of the Kingdom through Link's text choices. It's harder to see, however, because you have to pay attention to what Link is saying, as opposed to, okay, what's the next part of this conversation that I'm getting to? Which obviously means more work for us, but it can provide that if you're willing to look into it. I can look at Fi from Skyward Sword in this exact same vein. People despise Fi for basically being Navi Annoyance 2.0, literally upgrade version, because robotics. I love Fi's story, but it's very hard to see Fi's development. And that is partially on the creators for not giving Fi enough opportunities to shine. Just like with Navi, they stopped giving Navi opportunities to shine as soon as you leave the Deku Forest, the Kokiri Forest, for the first time. So again, it's that pairing up between the two. How much investment are the creators putting in, and how much investment are you putting in? And how much you put in is, of course, going to be dependent on what you want to do. What are you getting out of this game? What are you focused on? And for a game like Wind Waker, it's a lot easier to do that because of the design that is being given. It permits you to more freely emote because of these designs. It is designed like a child book story, which allows for that to very quickly connect with each other. While with something like Majora's Mask, you have to look a lot more closely. Oh, this is the connection between Anju and Kafei. This is the connection between Anju, Kafei, and Kremia. These connections do exist. With a lot of people, they just kind of make them up whole cloth. Fan shipping and fan fiction is a thing.
Oh, yeah.
And those are the kinds of investments that get people going and get people coming back to certain games over and over again. Why they prefer certain games over other games.
with Phantom Hourglass and Spirit Tracks. I want to give those games some attention. One thing that I will say, I prefer Spirit Tracks over Phantom Hourglass. One thing I do think Phantom Hourglass does kind of sort of beat out Spirit Tracks on is the characters. Now, Spirit Zelda, like Link and Zelda and Spirit Tracks, I love them so good. Much.
They're so adorable together.
So much. And having Anjean and also Burn as well be somewhat key characters, especially later in the game, is great. But throughout most of the game, it's just Link and Zelda. Again, I love them. But comparing that to Link, Ciela, and Linebeck, and Oshis even, that's just a fun group. Especially when you hit the halfway point in the ghost ship, and, you know, Oshis promises Linebeck a bunch of treasure, and he gets into action. Like, that group, those interactions are so good. And then Tetra later in the game, once you get Tetra saved, and then Oshis becomes a giant whale, it's just a... The characters, I think, are probably the best part of Phantom Hourglass for me. And it's because, like, Link has unique interactions with Linebeck and Ciela and Oshis, and obviously Tetra, and it's just so dynamic. And obviously Spirit Tracks, Link and Zelda, again, peak Zelink ship. I love them so much. But again, it's just those two for the majority of the time. Anjean sometimes, and then Burn at the very end. But like, it's just so good. It's so good. And Link is a big part of that. So I think Link needs to be able to show emotion as well as just somewhat of interest in what's happening. Too often in the Wild games, I think Age of Calamity also does a really good job of interactions with characters as well as Link a little bit. But with the Wild games, in well, we talked about the dialogue options, but just in the cutscenes, even he's just there, present, looking at people, but not engaged in any visible way. And I think if that one thing was tweaked, I think a lot of it'd be a domino effect of a lot of, you know, other things. But that, yeah, Link is a very key point in making this all work.
I play a good amount of Dungeons and Dragons, primarily as a DM, but occasionally as a player. It's mostly my choice. And when it comes to character creation, I think that I'm pretty good at creating a character and their backstory and everything that comes with character creation before a game. But regardless of the character that I am making, whether it is a full-on hero adventurer or just a side character, I may have a idea fully fleshed out of what that character is, what they want to do, what their personality is, but it never fully gets fleshed out until I'm actually playing that character. How does this character actually function? I can think, oh yeah, this person is a purely logical individual. In fact, I wanted to create a character like that. But once I actually started using that character started becoming something completely different. Instead of just being pure logic, they just ended up kind of being impatient with everybody. And that's just kind of how they develop. You don't understand how a character is supposed to react until they start reacting. What is it like for this character to start running into this character, this character, this character? Having things bounce off of that character is what fleshes them out. And that's why you love those character interactions in Phantom Hourglass. They're not just interacting with Link, they're interacting with each other. Ciela and Linebeck's banter is probably the best thing about that game.
It's
because Ciela is making fun of Linebeck the entire time. Linebeck's trying to dodge every single point blank accusation. It's great. And you get to see Linebeck develop through the whole game. Mm-hmm. It's so fun. We love Zelda in Spirit Tracks because we get to interact with Zelda. For the first time, she is a central figure. And we get to see her grow the entire game.
think what's resonating for me the most is like continuity. So having a character at the start of a game, seeing their development, whether that's Link, Tetra, Lineback, Link's sister in Wind Waker, for example, Aerol, like seeing their development through the game and seeing those character interactions as well. Like at the start of Wind Waker, you have Tetra and then the other pirates, and they're like picking on each other and just having those fun moments. And then if you compare it to like the Wild games, there's not the same continuity, in my opinion. Like you do your side quests, or sorry, you do your quests with Sidon, you do your quests with I'm blanking right now, Tulin, and so on, and then that's kind of it. They don't come back. So to summarize, that connective piece, having them reconvene at another point in time, I think would just make it a more like continuous experience. Yeah.
Yeah, big agree.
It's an interesting compare and contrast that we have to work with. Well, that is not to say that we don't love Tears of the Kingdom. And we love our characters. Freaking love Riju. Give me a re I want to read you in my life. Can I have that, please? That would be
Sure.
wonderful. Yes! Awesome. Dominic, you can
I'll
work on
find them
that
for
for
you.
me. Give me a Riju. I mean,
Don't
I
worry.
have the amiibo, but that doesn't
It's
count.
not the same.
It's not the same.
Yeah, I want to clarify. For as much as I give the Wild Games like slack, Tears of the Kingdom is my rank number 8 Zelda game. Breath of the Wild is 11, so it's a little bit low. But I still like them at a base level. I think they're really good games.
Breath of the Wild is my number 3. Tears of the
Oh.
Kingdom is my number 11. Wind Waker is number, I have the list here, 9. Spirit Tracks is 8.
Before we end, what are our top 5 Zelda games?
Again, I have the list right here.
That's a tough one. Blanket.
Number 5 is Echoes of Wisdom. Number
Nice.
4, Ocarina of Time. 3, Breath of the Wild. 2, Twilight Princess. 1 is Skyward Sword.
My top 5. Number 5, Spirit Tracks. Number 4, Skyward Sword. 3, Wind Waker. 2, Twilight Princess. 1, Majora's Mask.
I was half expecting a drum roll from you since you do percussion.
Oh, my desk isn't really suited for that.
I don't know. I think, honestly, let's go Majora's Mask number 5. Let's go Ocarina of Time number 4. Wind Waker, I'm gonna say number 3, even though I've hyped it up so much.
You can do that.
Number
I could spend all
2.
day hyping up Tears of the Kingdom, and it's only number
Twilight
11.
Princess or Twilight Princess or Breath of the Wild. And then Link to the Past, I think, has got to be number 1. Easy choice.
Nice.
It is such a good game.
No expression from anybody whatsoever in that game. Just so you
It
know.
was the 90s.
So good. I love it. I'm just
Honorable
it's
mention.
except once again, it's we can hype up one thing and it not even be our favorite.
Yeah.
I think to summarize my experience of Wind Waker, I love the plot. I love the narrative. I'm biased because when I first played it, I was a little kid. I hadn't seen the world. So it
You
really left
sweet
an
summer
impression
child.
on me.
My first
So,
Zelda game was the original. I was
right?
dying and getting lost everywhere.
Yeah. Now, going back to Wind Waker, it's not quite the same because the mechanics are very janky compared to Tears of the Kingdom. But I want a Zelda game that recaptures that humanity. Play a game where I'm not just playing as Link. Someone I want to, like, someone to care about. That's what I want.
It's a self-insert. Care about yourself.
I do.
Everybody, care about yourselves. And on that note... And on that note for self-love, thank you all so much for joining us here at the Zelda Universe Podcast. Been great to have you all here and listening, and hope you will come back and join us again next month. Caden, Dominic, thank you both for hanging out and chatting, talking about these wonderful games in this franchise.
Thank you so much.
And we will see you all next time in ZUcast.
Bye.